there, but I do want to light your attention back to 2 Samuel chapter number 16, and we pick up our study of the life of David and really preaching through 2 Samuel. Write it down. I'm going to read it, and I want you to cling to it and think on this, the few verses that we're going to talk about this afternoon. Proverbs 18:13 states that he that answers a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame unto him. For someone to respond, react, reply to a situation before they've heard it fully or thought of it fully, it is folly and shame. Now think about that. Go with me in your minds back several weeks now to our study of 2 Samuel. And David has fled the capital. He has left the city proper, crossed over the Kidron Brook, up the Mount of Olives, and is cresting the Mount of Olives, running for his life. His son Absalom has staged a coup d'etat. His son, if you go back to chapter 15, stole the hearts of the people. And through empty political promises and sweet talking, he's gotten the people behind him, several prominent people behind him, and he's run his daddy off the throne. Let me remind you, Absalom was the heir apparent. He was the next in line, but he was not content to wait for David to die so that he could take the throne through the death of his father. Instead, Absalom wanted to be king, and he wanted to be king right then, right now. So he stages this coup, drives his father from the throne. And as David is leaving, the last time that we were together, we looked at, I believe, five positives, five good things that we could learn about how to react in bad circumstances, bad situations. That even in the midst of David fleeing, he was still worshiping God, he was still praying, he was still using wisdom. There was a number of positives that could be learned even in this time of turmoil by considering the life of David. Today, we will look at what not to do and what David should not have done. Now, it's sort of easy for us, as we sit here and read this, to be critical or harsh or even somewhat judgmental of David's actions and the actions of others. But do realize that this is a heat of the moment. David is, as far as he knows, running for his life. He doesn't know what Absalom's intentions are, how far away Absalom and his armies are. And so as he is fleeing, David is not at his best. Now, there's a sense in which, as I said last time, we can learn from him. But don't forget this. And this is important. What David is enduring is the consequences of the sin that he had committed. Now, he had already confessed his sin. God had already forgiven him his sin. David has repented of his sin. But he is still facing the consequences of his sin. And we need to be reminded of that just because we know God will forgive us and God is gracious and God is good. That's not a license to lasciviousness. In other words, that doesn't grant us the right to go out and do wrong. David, if you went back to chapter 12, David was told by the prophet of God, here's what's going to happen. From your own household, one will rise up and do evil against you. And this is happening, yes, because of Absalom's selfish desire to be king, but it is also a consequence of David's sin. And so, yes, as David is fleeing, he's still praying, he's weeping, he's fearful the people who are with him are unsure what the future may hold. And there's some good things. But in this text, we're going to see what David did not do well. And hang on to that proverb that I read earlier. It will matter to you more in just a minute. And we're only going to look at the first four verses. We have a business meeting this afternoon, so I don't want to keep you forever. But let's do this, and then we'll get into more, Lord willing, next Sunday. Verse 1 says, "And when David was a little past the top of the hill, that is the Mount of Olives, cresting the Mount of Olives, leaving, behold, Ziba, a servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of asses or donkey saddles, and upon them 200 loaves of bread, and 100 bunches of raisins, and 100 summer fruits, and a bottle of wine. And the king said unto Ziba, What meanest thou by these? And Ziba said, The asses be for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine that such as be faint in the wilderness may drink. And the king said, And where is thy master's son? And Ziba said unto the king, Behold, he abideth at Jerusalem, for he said, And this is Ziba putting words in the mouth of Mephibosheth. Today shall the house of Israel restore me the kingdom of my father. Then said the king to Ziba, Behold, thine are all that pertained unto Mephibosheth. And Ziba said, I humbly beseech thee that I may find grace in thy sight, my lord, O king. Today I want to speak on the thought of conning the king. Conning the king, because that's what Ziba is. He is a con man. He's a con artist. He's a crook. And unfortunately, he is able to con the king. As we look at this narrative, we see David as he is fleeing, and we are again introduced to Ziba. Now, you have to go back, and you can go back to chapter number 9 at your leisure, and you can go back and you can find a little bit more, but I'm going to try to give you a brief summary. Remember that Ziba was a servant of Saul, King Saul. And after the death of Saul, Ziba pretty much inherited everything that belonged to Saul. His lands, his properties, his wealth, his money and those kinds of things. Ziba was leading a good life. Chapter number 9, if you look, and I said I wasn't going to read it all, but I do want you to just get this part of it. Chapter number 9, this is David's mercy to Mephibosheth. Again, Mephibosheth is the son of Jonathan, Jonathan the son of Saul. So Mephibosheth was the cripple who had been crippled by fall. His nursemaid had picked him up to run with him. Word came in that Saul had been killed, all the sons of Saul had been killed, Jonathan was killed. And so this nurse picks up Mephibosheth, takes off running with him. She falls, Mephibosheth is injured, and he becomes a cripple. He can't walk. Later on, David wants to show kindness to the house of Jonathan. The only one left is Mephibosheth, and he's a cripple. So David sends for him to have him brought from the land of Lodibar, the land of no bread, or really the land of nothingness, barrenness. David has Mephibosheth come, and Mephibosheth just falls down before him and says, who am I? In fact, his words are, I'm just a dog, just a dead dog in front of you. I don't deserve your mercy. But David, and this is just a glorious picture of salvation, David extends mercy to this undeserving cripple who had been broken by a fall, brings him in and makes him as one of his own sons, which is what God by grace does for us, who have been crippled by a fall, undeserving, But because of, not us, but because of who our Father is, well, we are shown mercy. But up until David gives Mephibosheth all that should have rightly been his, a servant named Ziba was running things. Again, Saul was a wealthy man. He was king. Once he was killed, disposed as king, he still had a lot of wealth. But Saul's family was all gone, and Ziba was running the show. And he liked it. He had a good life. His master was gone, but he still had lots of land and wealth. 2 Samuel chapter number 9, verse 9, then the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said unto him, I have given unto thy master's son all that pertained to Saul and to all his household. Thou therefore and thy sons and thy servants, so he was a servant who had servants, shall till the land, so there was land, thou shalt bring in fruits, so and thy master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, thy master's son, shall eat bread always at my table. And notice the close of verse 10. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So Ziba was living the good life until Mephibosheth come around. He had inherited that which belonged to Saul, not by right, but just simply because of Saul's absence. So he's leading a good life. Things are good. And then all of a sudden, King David says, Ziba, you're now a servant of Mephibosheth. So no more are you running your own show. You're not top dog anymore. You're back to the position of a servant. Not now of Saul, but of Saul's grandson, Mephibosheth. And doubtless, this did not settle well with Ziba. Things were going along spot on good. You could just sort of imagine him sitting back in his rocking chair, taking it easy. He had his servants, and he had 15 sons, so he probably had a plurality of wives. You know, he was leading a good life till David came in. And now he says, you're no longer the man in charge. You are Mephibosheth. You are the servant of this cripple. And now, fast forward to where we are, chapter 16. Now, Ziba sees the opportunity to make himself look real good and to make Mephibosheth look real bad. And he seizes that opportunity. With David, verse 1, was a little past the top of the hill. Here comes Ziba. Now understand this. The things that Ziba brings weren't his. They were the property of Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth met him. Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, meets David. He's got some donkeys that are saddled or ready to be ridden. He has bread, he has raisins, he has summer fruits, and he has a bottle of wine. And all of this is to just help David on his journey, right? He's had to leave, had to flee at a moment's notice, doesn't know where he's going, doesn't know how long he's going to be. But I'm convinced, and my study, I think, has will bear this out, that all of this is either Mephibosheth sending Ziba and saying, go do this, which I think that's really what it is, or Ziba just sort of twisting and distorting what Mephibosheth said or wanted. So Ziba shows up to David. They're at the top of the Mount of Olives. David's getting ready to take off into the wilderness, this barrenness. And here comes Ziba bearing these gifts. And David says in verse number 2, what does this mean? You know, why did you bring these things? And he says, oh, king, I'm just trying to help you out. Just want to be a friend. These donkeys are here for you and your family to ride on. The bread and the fruit for the young men. The wine for those who may need something to drink. And so David's response was, where is Mephibosheth? Verse 3. Where is your master's son? And really, he's just asking, where is Mephibosheth? Where is Saul's grandson, is what he's, is the language, but where's Mephibosheth? And notice Ziba's dishonest response. He's in Jerusalem, for he said, now this is just, if I'm wrong, I'll go to my grave being wrong. But he lied. He just went, because Mephibosheth said, today the house of Israel will be restored unto the kingdom of my father. Now, there's holes big enough to drive a Mack truck through with that line of reasoning. First of all, it's a farce. It's a lie. But beyond that, the kingdom was not being restored to the household of Saul. The kingdom was going to be given to Absalom. Absalom was the one bringing in his armies, not descendants of Saul or of Jonathan. And so David should have immediately saw through, that don't make any sense. What? That's crazy. But David is not thinking clearly. We can understand, right? He's anxious. He's upset. He's on the run again. His son, whom he loves, has betrayed him. His best friend and chief counselor, Ahithophel, has betrayed him. He's having to flee the city. He's not thinking clearly. And more than that, he should have known what Deuteronomy says, that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every word be established. Jesus said the same thing when talking about church discipline in Matthew chapter number 18. There should be the testimony of two or three. Paul writes to Timothy and says, against an elder, receive not an accusation except at the mouth of two or three witnesses. What David does is he jumps to the wrong conclusion. He automatically receives this statement from Ziba, which was a self-serving lie. Can I read this to you again? He that answers a matter before he hears it or hears of it fully, it is folly and shame unto him. Again, Proverbs 18, verse 13. Solomon, David's son, would write those wise words, and he's right. Yes, we look at what David did write in this last study we did 18 weeks ago, but David is all wrong here. It has been said that the only exercise some people get is jumping to conclusions. That could probably be said of me. And it is an easy failure for all of us that when we hear something, and especially maybe when we're not at our best, we immediately receive it as if it was a gospel truth. Without hearing, there's an old statement, right? There are two sides to every story. And wisdom says, you don't leap to conclusions based on one person's word. You don't automatically side with somebody. All of us, listen, every single one of us adults, every one of us, and kids too, listen, all of us have had friends who have come to us and talked to us about a certain situation. This happened, and they did this, and she did that, and yada, yada, yada. And we are naturally inclined to side with that individual because we're close to them, or they're our friends, or maybe we already sort of dislike or distrust that other individual. But if you go making conclusions, jumping to conclusions, before you've heard the whole matter, it is folly and it is shame. Were the three friends of Job, right in all their accusations against him? The answer is no. They leapt to the conclusion, Job, you must have really done something wrong, that God has brought all this calamity on you. Well, the truth is what? Not that David had done everything wrong, he had done everything right. Yet they leapt to the conclusion, not based on any evidence other than what they thought, that Job must have been involved in gross sin. Again, in the Old Testament, after the Israelites are finally battling over the promised land, they're through. The conquering is not fully complete, but nearly complete. The 2.5 tribes that stayed trans-Jordan over on the other side of the Jordan, they went to go back. They had done, met their commitment. They stayed and fought until the land was settled. And as they go back to cross over the Jordan, they build an altar. And the 9.5 tribes wrongly assume that the 2.5 tribes that are about to cross over the Jordan to go back to their land, and their apportioned land, that they're trying to build an altar to a false god. And so they were literally getting ready to enter into civil war. Now, this is going on back in our Sunday evening studies. But they were literally about to enter into civil war when those 2.5 tribes said, no, no, no. This is a memorial stone. This is not an altar for false gods. We don't want you all to forget that we met our responsibilities and that we too are Israelites, even if we're living on the other side of the river, we're still family. But because they leapt to the wrong conclusion, they were ready to go to war. And here, David sets before us this wrong-headed, irrational, emotional response that every one of us should guard against. And I will say this, especially in the world in which we live, when we are inundated with, especially those of us who are on social media, with here is the link to an article, and people jump to conclusions about the article without ever even reading the article. Or they see a post and they automatically assume it's true, when it could be a complete farce, it could be completely made up. I'm not naive enough to think that all the fact checkers on Facebook are legitimate. Yet at the same time, we should promote honesty and integrity, should we not, as Christians? And not promote things that may or may not be true by jumping to conclusion just because that guy said something I happen to agree with. Here, David makes a wrong-headed decision, jumping to a conclusion. The king gets conned. It's just that simple. Ziba is a con man. And he fools King David. What does David say in response to him? Verse 4, then said the king to Ziba, behold, everything, and I'm going to summarize that for you, everything that I gave to Mephibosheth, I'm now giving back to you. Do you like it when people who should know better jump to the wrong conclusion about you? Do you like it? I don't. And listen, people who should know better, people who know you, right, that you've been around a little while, they ought to know you, and then they hear something, and then they automatically side against you or jump to a conclusion against you and never even bother asking you from your side of the thing. That's exactly how David did Mephibosheth. And I know that Mephibosheth could care less about Absalom or about his family's return to the throne. If you can handle a little bit of a spoiler alert, turn in a couple chapters, ahead a couple chapters, chapter number 19. Spoiler alert, David's going to come back to the city. Okay? He's going to come back to the city, and when he comes back, Mephibosheth will meet him this time. In my mind, Mephibosheth said to Ziba, "Ziba, go get us a couple of donkey saddles, grab up a bunch of food and some drink. We're going to take it to David because he's going to need help." But before the cripple ever made it to the donkeys, Ziba took off, gave the stuff to David, and made up a lie. In my mind, that's how I see it unfolding, okay? And I base that some of what we'll read about right here. Because Mephibosheth's heart is for David. Chapter number 19, verse 24. And Mephibosheth, the son, really grandson, but we care more about those technicalities than Hebrew writers did. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And notice this, he had neither dressed his feet or cleaned his feet, which is not good for a cripple, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. And it came to pass when he was come to Jerusalem, that is when David, Mephibosheth, to meet the king, that the king said unto him, "Wherefore, or why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" Verse 26, and he answered, "My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For thy servant said, I will saddle me an ass, that I may ride thereon, and go to the king, because I'm lame, because thy servant is lame. And he has slandered me, thy servant, unto my lord the king. But my lord the king is as an angel of God. Do therefore whatever is good in thine eyes." So do you hear what Mephibosheth is saying? Ziba fooled me. He deceived me. And that's why I say in my mind on that night when David is fleeing the city, Mephibosheth had said, "Hey, we got to make sure David's taken care of. Get us some stuff ready. I'll be there as quick as I can." And Ziba just takes off and, very greedily makes up this lie about Mephibosheth. And now as David is returning back to the city, Mephibosheth trying to explain to him what's happened. But unfortunately, again, and we'll get to chapter 19 at some point, unfortunately David does not respond with the kind of care and compassion that he should. He says to him, "You do whatever is right, I don't care." Verse 28, "For all my father's house were but dead men before the king. You showed me mercy. I'm giving you my summary of it. What right, therefore, have I yet to cry any more unto the king?" Verse 29, "The king said unto him, I don't want to talk about this anymore. You and Ziba just divide the land." It's a very discompassionate response. I don't know who's lying. I don't know who's right. I don't know who's wrong. Y'all just split it and be done with it. But notice verse 30. Mephibosheth said unto the king, "Yea, let him take off. For as much as my lord the king is come again in peace unto his own house." In other words, Mephibosheth says, "He can have it all. I don't care. The only thing I care about, David, is that you are safely back ruling and reigning like you should be." That tells us when you look at chapter 9, when David sends for Mephibosheth and his response, Mephibosheth's faithfulness, that he refuses to bathe himself, trim his beard, all of that is mourning. That's mourning language. Weeping and mourning the whole time David is driven into the wilderness. And when he comes back, David says, "I don't want to hear about it. Y'all just split it." And Mephibosheth's response is, "I don't care about the land. I care about you." It tells us about the character and nature of Mephibosheth. And it tells us that David was wrong in leaping to this conclusion listening to the distorted, twisted, selfish lies of sin. So yes, we can learn what's right from the life of David, but here's another example of what he did wrong. Now, Christian, this week, when your BFF comes running to you, says, you're not going to believe what such and such happened, are you going to jump to a conclusion? Are you going to automatically assume they're telling the truth? Are you certain that they're telling the whole story? Or is it possible they're just telling the part that makes them look good? We do that, don't we? Let a husband and wife get into an argument. It'd be amazing what you remember and what you don't. Not Pat and I, but others probably have that. Right? In your marriage, your relationships, he who answers a matter, that is, you react, you respond, you reply before you hear it fully, is folly and shame. And what we find here in David is folly and shame. Well, two quick things. Ziba was able to con King David. But nobody will ever be able to con King Jesus.
Amen.
Nobody will ever be able to fool him. Listen, he won't jump to conclusions. Because I promise you, he knows the whole story. He knows it all. He is the omnipotent judge who rules and reigns over all. And on that great day of judgment, men may come to him and try and tell him lies and distort the truth and make themselves look good and their selfishness and their greed and, Lord, don't you know this? And the Lord will say, oh yeah, I know. I'm not jumping to any conclusions. I know all there is to know about you. Ziba pulled the wool over David's eyes, but you won't pull the wool over Jesus' eyes. He knows. But then secondly, I'm glad that Jesus, King Jesus, extends mercy to selfish storytellers who like to tell things in a way that makes them sound good and others sound bad. Because I've done that myself. I've been a selfish storyteller. I wanted to gossip a little bit. Maybe I wanted to spread a little of this. But I was always sure, aren't we? To tell it so that it makes us look good and somebody else look bad. And I'm glad that Christ came and lived that perfect life that we don't. And died the death that we deserve and rose again to give eternal life to men and women like Ziba, who manipulate, distort, twist, wrangle the truth into something else, because I've done all of those and more. And yet the King has shown me mercy. Here in just a few little verses, we can again see the strengths and the weakness of David. But it also reminds us of the absolute glory of the Son of David, who will never be fooled, who would, I promise, weak, fallen men, and I, in our minds we picture these things, will never be able to confuse the King, not King Jesus. So, God help us. Don't be like the friends of Job, jumping to conclusions. Don't make bad decisions. Find out the whole story. Find out the whole truth about the thing. Jesus never did that. He was always very careful. And there's a preacher friend of mine that every once in a while I'll call him, and I'm prone to this too. I may be talking to him about something, and I sort of want him to side with me. But he just refuses. He's like, look, I ain't talking to that other person. I don't know maybe what was said or that wasn't said. I'm not calling you a liar. I'm not taking sides. Now, that's not popular. Like, people don't like that. But it is spiritual maturity. God bless you. I hope you have a good afternoon.